Hello and welcome to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. In this hour, is China militarizing the South China Sea? That's one of a few concerns for many in the region about China's territorial claims and its development of a region that also has claims by the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Brunei. What exactly is brewing in the South China Sea? But first, an edible history of humanity, how food has shaped history as a weapon of war, of empire, and of building societies. Throughout history, food has played many roles in changing the world. It's been a weapon of war, an offering for peace, a force of development, imperialism, and an organizer of societies. In many cases, food and its production have had some of the most profound effects on humanity, and indeed on the earth itself. It's affected social status, social roles, empires, and war outcomes. With us is a writer who has documented these roles in his latest book, The Edible History of Humanity. Tom Standage, welcome.
Hello, good to be here.
Great to have you here with us. So let's start from the back of your book with food as a weapon of war.
Yes, so if you ask yourself the question, what's the most devastating weapon in the whole of history? People would probably say, you know, the atom bomb or the machine gun or something like that. But I think if you really do the numbers, the weapon that's probably been most devastating is actually food. And this is something that was recognized as long ago as the Roman period. There was a Roman writer in the 4th century AD who said, starvation destroys an army more often than does battle, and hunger is more savage than the sword. And this is because in the old days, you had armies marching around. You had to give them food so they could keep moving around, and you had to give them food so they'd have enough energy to wave their weapons. So food was basically fuel. And it was kind of ammunition as well, because it was what powered your army. And generals who weren't able to cope with the logistics of providing enough food to their soldiers wouldn't even get to the battlefield to fight the battle. So the battles that occur are the ones where, you know, the logistics at least has gone well enough to get the two armies into the same place. But actually, if you look at the history of military conflict, there are quite a lot of battles which are forced upon one of the participants because they don't have enough food. And there are quite a lot of conflicts as well where the inability to maintain the flow of food actually affects the outcome. A good example of that would be the Revolutionary War, in fact, or the American War of Independence, as we call it on this side of the pond, because I'm in London. And what happened there, essentially, was that the mightiest empire in the world at the time, the British Empire, was unable to defeat the American colonists who wanted independence, in large part because the British soldiers had to be supplied from across the Atlantic. And maintaining the supply of food across the waters was just very, very difficult logistically.
You also mentioned the Civil War in your book, and that food had a major role in that outcome.
Yes, in that case, you get the march to the sea, and you get the deliberate devastation of the agricultural productivity of the South. And what's happening there is that the agricultural regions are sending food north by rail to the troops. And so there's this deliberate effort by Sherman to disrupt agricultural production in the South and prevent that from happening. So we get this time and time again. And another famous example is Napoleon's march on Moscow, his attempt to invade Russia. And the problem there was his supply lines were stretched, you know, far too long. There wasn't food available on the land, which was his usual tactic, to feed his troops. Napoleon had previously had great success in his military career because he was able to draw food from the land and not worry about complicated supply lines. He rediscovered the ancient art of feeding an army from the land. But of course, to make that work, you have to have food available. The best time to attack is just after the harvest so that the barns are all full. And you have to keep your army moving because if it stops, they deplete the local area of any food and then you run out and then the army starves. So he had discovered all of this in his previous campaigns in Europe, had been extremely successful. And then he came unstuck when he attacked Russia because his supply lines, he knew there wasn't going to be food there. He had a very elaborate system and there was mud and trouble with the carriages. The army got ahead of the supplies. The Russians had stripped the countryside of anything else to eat. And that was, you know, before a single shot had been fired, he had lost a huge number of men and horses. And it all went downhill from there.
And then when you went to the Cold War, you said it actually began in earnest with a food fight in Berlin. Explain that.
Yes. Well, the blockade of Berlin was this bizarre situation where West Berlin was a divided city in the middle of East Germany. And as one of the communist leaders at the time said, what happens to Berlin happens to Germany, and what happens to Germany happens to Europe. And so the defense of West Berlin for the Western powers became a sort of test of their resolve in standing up to the communists. And the communist, the East German surrounding area, basically all of the landlines access to West Germany was cut. The barges weren't allowed to get through. The trains weren't allowed to get through. The roads were closed. And so there was no way to get food through to the Western-controlled sectors of Berlin. And so the Western powers decided that an airlift, which they assumed would only have to, you know, run for a few days, would be necessary. And they started to ship food and fuel and other necessities over to West Berlin. But in fact, it turned out that they didn't... they had to end up doing it for 15 months. It wasn't a few days. And they had to scale it up and up and up and up because they, once they'd started it, they couldn't possibly back down. It would have been a terrible admission of defeat. West Berlin would have fallen, and it would have been, you know, a terrible symbolic defeat for the Western powers who were trying to stand up to communism at the time. So ultimately, after 15 months, it became clear that they were serious about this, and the blockade was eventually lifted by the Soviet Union. So it all sounds rather trivial, and there's a poster which I very much like from this period. It was made by Douglas, the aircraft maker, which provided a lot of the planes that were used in the airlift, and it says, "Milk, new weapon of democracy." And the idea was that food was being used as a weapon to defend democracy, and by providing a steady supply of food, and of course it was largely American and British airmen, and they were supplying it to German citizens who only a few months earlier had been their enemies during World War II. But suddenly the defense of democracy and freedom in the face of the threat from the Soviet Union became more important, and food became a very valuable weapon in that fight.
Which explains why there have been these food drops throughout history for efforts in winning wars. Then you went on to talk about Stalin's famine and Mao's famine.
Yes.
Tell us about those.
Well, the idea of communism is that if we all pull together, you know, the world will be a better place, and we'll all sort of we'll all contribute, and we won't have individual property, and we won't have sort of competition. We'll all get paid the same, and it all sounds great on paper. But when you actually try and implement it, and in particular when you try and implement it in a largely agricultural society, which Russia was when Stalin tried it and China was when Mao tried it, and the idea is if you collectivize the farms, you crunch all of the small farms together and you say, okay, folks, you're all going to work together on a big farm. What the communist leaders thought in both cases is that this would increase the amount of food that was produced. Everybody would be, you know, on the same team. They'd all work together. In fact, the opposite happens, because if you're a farmer and you're producing your own food, you have an incentive to work hard and produce more food because you can sell it and you'll have more money to spend on other things. But if you're in a collectivized farm where everyone is basically getting the same pay, in fact they're being paid, you know, they're being given accommodation and food and so on, it takes away your incentive to work harder. So the exact opposite happened, and actually less food came out of the countryside after collectivization than Stalin had expected. And he was using this to demonstrate the superiority of the communist model as he saw it. And the idea was that to prove to the rest of the world how wonderful communism was, the enormous increase in wheat production that would happen after collectivization would be used, and you know, the wheat would be exported, the extra wheat, and this would be used to buy industrial machinery, and this would fund the industrialization of Russia. This was his plan. The problem was that actually the amount of food went down, but he'd already committed himself to this export plan. So the food was exported instead, and Stalin and his supporters were initially absolutely certain that the people in the countryside were simply hiding all the extra food that they must be producing. So they had this very draconian campaigns of searching everyone's houses and looking for it, and then they assumed it was being stolen and so on. But the simple truth was it wasn't there at all, that the output of the countryside had actually gone down. And the result was a massive famine in the Ukraine. And then this entire scenario was replayed, you know, in a very similar way in China. The Chinese fell for the Russian propaganda that communism improved your farming output, and they tried to do exactly the same thing. And again, you know, the actual output fell. Nobody dared tell Mao. and they faked all the numbers, and they told him that actually there were record harvests, and none of it was true. And there was another massive famine, and the result was tens of millions of people died. And these were the biggest famines in the 20th century, and they were entirely man-made, and they, the basis of them was the ideology of communism. So this was sort of food as a weapon, they hoped, against the rest of the world to prove the power of communism. But in fact, it ended up being a weapon that mainly killed their own people.
Now, when you documented the early days of food, it's interesting because it was collectivized until farming came into being. You even talked about hunters and gatherers always shared their food with the entire community.
Yep.
And then that changed when farming started.
And so, in fact, Marx and Engels, the creators of the doctrine of communism, were inspired, they said, by the discovery in the 19th century by anthropologists at the time. They started to examine the lifestyles of hunter-gatherers, of which there are still some today, and there were then as well. And the idea of the noble savage and so forth became very popular. It turned out that hunter-gatherers have very little property, and what little property they have, they share. And this is actually entirely practical if you're a hunter-gatherer, because if you've got a band of people traveling around trying to get food from the land, you don't really want to all be weighed down with lots of possessions. So it makes a lot of sense for, you know, me to carry a net and you carry a spear and someone else will carry a bow. And it doesn't necessarily make sense for all of us to own all of those things. And in fact, if we do and we all start to try and accumulate goods and try and compete with each other to own more stuff, we'll actually suffer as a band because we'll be so weighed down with this that, you know, we'll be less able to chase after that woolly mammoth that's going past than another band, which is sharing everything. And so there's a sort of selection effect where the groups of hunter-gatherers who are able to actually share things and get over the idea of, you know, building up their own superiority over others or their own collection of goods, they'll actually do better. And so it's a sort of social technology that was developed. Essentially, bands that followed this sharing routine would do better than ones that didn't. And in fact, in surviving hunter-gatherers, you can still see examples of this. And anthropologists have documented this, where, you know, if you're holding the knife today, you know, other people will start to, you know, gently rib you about it and say, oh, look at him, he thinks he's so great, he's got the knife. And this will prompt you to give it to someone else, just to emphasize the fact that you're not trying to sort of lord it over everyone else because you've got that particularly high status item. Similarly, there are rules in some hunting tribes where if you bring down an animal, you're not allowed to eat any of it. You have to give it to everyone else, and they share it out. And the only way you're allowed to get some is that your family members are allowed to pass some meat back to you. And then there are other rules where, you know, the arrow that brings down the animal determines who gets to distribute the meat. But before going hunting, the men all swap arrows with each other. So I may fire the arrow, but if it doesn't belong to me, which it won't do, then somebody else gets to distribute the meat. So there are all of these tricks that are used to ensure that no one member of the band tries to sort of exert authority over everyone else, and everyone is very equal and everything is shared. And in the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, that works extremely well. But as soon as agriculture comes in, people have settled, it starts to become possible to accumulate goods. Some people are better at farming than others, and they have more produce, and they can then use that and trade that with other people. And you instantly get this, well, in archaeological time anyway, you instantly get this division into rich and poor. And if you look at the graves of early agricultural villages, you've got people who are buried with stuff and people who aren't buried with stuff. And it seems to be that, you know, there is accumulation of wealth going on, and there are high-status people and lower-status people, and you've got the beginnings of a stratification of society. And so that idea of economic inequality seems to go hand-in-hand with the settled agricultural lifestyle, which is, of course, the basis of modern civilization. So inequality seems to be kind of baked into the way civilization works.
And then you talked about food as currency, food as a tax, although in some cases you said it was really labor that was the currency and the tax. So give us a little bit about Egypt, Mesopotamia.
Well, in all of these early civilizations, yes, you have various schemes whereby an elite establishes itself, typically of 10 to 20% of the population. The rest of the population are farmers, and tax system is introduced so that the farmers, that 80% of the population produces enough food for everyone. So they're producing more than just the food they need to feed themselves. They're also producing enough food to feed the elite. And the elite justifies the handing over of the surplus food using usually religious grounds. So it's very similar, the sort of religious justification that's used in Mesopotamia, in South America, in Egypt, in China. Essentially, the elite says to the masses, the gods make the crops grow, but they'll only do it if we offer them sacrifices in the form of food or whatever, but it's usually food in some form. And so therefore, you need to give us food, and then we will make the offerings to the gods, and then the gods will continue to ensure that your crops grow next year. So this is sort of cycle. And essentially, the elite says to the masses, you know, you mustn't disrupt this cycle or your crops won't grow. So that's how they stay on top of the much larger farming population, using this this religious rhetoric that this is, you know, the just order of things, that there are peasants, there are rulers, and there are gods. And you get this, you know, strikingly similar setup even in different parts of the world, separated by centuries. But anyway, that's how it works. And so the surplus that's then collected by the elite is then used by the elite to fund things. Because if you've got food, then it's a currency that you can use to buy people's labor. So if I'm a pharaoh and I've got a whole load of surplus wheat, then I can say, okay, I'm going to build a pyramid and I'm going to use this wheat to essentially, you know, feed the army of people I'll get to do it. It's how I'll pay for it. The pyramids were not built by slaves. They were built by laborers who were taken off the land and given surplus food from the coffers of the state. And that was how you could do it. And similarly, if you wanted to wage war, well, then you'd need food as a currency to pay your soldiers. And if you had an agricultural surplus, then you would have that food at your disposal. So this was how you could start to fund state things like wars and monumental architecture and irrigation projects and so forth.
There are two more things I'd like for you to cover. One is the role of spices and how much that has played into empire and imperialism. Give us that history.
In my book, I look at lots of ways in which food has affected history, and there are different foods that do different things, but probably the group of foods that made the most difference after the basic agricultural staples, which led to settlement and civilization, are spices. And spices are these incredibly highly valued goods that were transported all over the old world from Europe right the way to China and vice versa, depending on what was going in which direction. And they were used to sort of connect up different civilizations. So, in fact, you know, frankincense reached China from Arabia, and spices like nutmeg and cloves, which come from the South Seas, made it all the way into Europe shortly after the sort of Roman period. So these were the things that were traded over longest distances. They were very valuable. They were nutritionally completely useless. It's just that they showed how rich you were if you could afford to have them. And it was spices that inspired Columbus to go west. He was actually looking for gold and spices. If you look in his account of the journey, he thought that he would be able to get to the Indies if he sailed west. And of course, instead, he found the Americas. And he then spent the whole time looking for spices. He had no idea what the spices looked like when they were growing. And of course, none of the spices he was looking for were actually in the Americas. He was looking for black pepper and things like that. And then similarly, the Portuguese, so Vasco da Gama, was looking for a way to get to India and the spices, and he chose a different route round the bottom of Africa. And of course, that approach did actually work. And so the opening up of these massive sea trade routes and the establishment of European empires and the peopling of the Americas and the slave trade and all of this sort of thing then follows from that. And that has, you know, obviously had a massive impact on the unfolding of world history and the way that the world is today. And it was to chase after these really rather superfluous foodstuffs.
One last question, what I think is one of the most important questions, which deals with how farming has profoundly altered the planet itself.
Right. So farming is the thing that has made the biggest difference to the environment of Earth. It's you could call it the biggest environmental disaster in history. And if you look, we've used 40% of the Earth's surface for agriculture. So what I like to say is, if farming was invented today, you know, environmentalists would never allow it, because it's led to huge ecosystem destruction. I'm in Britain now. The natural state of Britain, you know, is not beautiful fields with sheep and the odd tree. It is, in fact, you know, forests of oak with wild boar running around. So when we look at an agricultural landscape, we think it's natural and we think it's beautiful. But in fact, it's just as man-made as the Manhattan skyline.
Well, I'd like to thank you, Tom Standage. The book is called An Edible History of Humanity. It's quite fun to read. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
When we come back, what exactly is brewing in the South China Sea? Stay tuned.
Mothers, daughters, and children flee. His advancing army of liberty. His swords so swift with death's indifference. And in his torture prisons, shackled innocence. But the souls of those he's trampled upon won't rest until his bloody crown of hate and fear lie buried in the ground. Let the war be done. Let the peace be won. Let the war be done. Let the peace be won now.
You are listening to the Scholar Circle, scholarcircle.org. I'm Maria Armudian. China's territorial claims and its development of the South China Sea have raised concerns of other countries that also claim territories in the same region, the Philippines, Vietnam, Malaysia, and Brunei. The situation was complicated further when U.S. naval ships began patrolling the region around one of China's man-made islands. China's naval chief warned that a minor incident could result in war. What is brewing in the South China Sea, and what does it mean for the region and for China-U.S. relations? Four experts join us now. Dr. Pradeep Taneja lectures in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne and is the author of The European Union and China, Interests and Dilemmas. Dr. Stephen Noakes is also with us. He's a lecturer in politics and international relations and Asian studies at the University of Auckland. He's the author of Support for Civil Society in China. Daniel Lynch is also with us. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and the author of After the Propaganda State, Media, Politics, and Thought in Reform China, Rising China, and Asian Democratization. Leszek Buzinski is with us. He's a professor at Australian National University and the author of Asia-Pacific Security, Values and Identity. Welcome to the Scholar Circle. Great to have all four of you here with us. I like to start to understand these political developments with a historic context. Leszek Buzinski, could you tell us what historically we need to understand to make sense of this dispute?
A very complex issue, but basically what we have is a Chinese claim based on what many consider to be rather dubious grounds and which clashes with Malaysian claims. And Vietnamese have a claim which is similar to the Chinese and has similar weaknesses, which they are unwilling to admit. But the Malaysians and the Filipinos have moved much more closely to uncross the law of the sea, and that creates a very complex situation here, where China is increasingly basing its claim upon dubious historical grounds, and the others have moved towards UNCLOS as the justification for their claims, in particular its exclusive economic zone and continental shelf. And so one aspect of the whole dispute is China's historical claim versus the legal claims of the ASEAN claimants. How that works out in the future is a matter for discussion.
Dan Lynch, why don't we bring you in? I know you've been looking at this issue quite a bit, too. First of all, would you agree with the characterization? And I understand this is a 20-year-plus issue. So bring us up to speed as to how this is developed.
Well, as early as 1992, the Chinese National People's Congress passed a law codifying China's claims to the South China Sea. That was important from a legal point of view because it would then allow the PRC state mechanisms to lease plots of water, if you will, sections of the water for possible oil and natural gas exploration. And there were a few incidents like Mischief Reef incident when the PLA quietly occupied this tiny reef off the coast of the Philippines in the winter of 94-95. There were a few incidents like that. But it's only since the global financial crisis in end of 2008, early 2009, since then, the Chinese state has become much more assertive. Some people use the term aggressive and other terms, and it's very obvious in asserting their claims and following through and making it look like they actually claim the entire South China Sea, although they haven't stated that formally yet. There are two real theories as to why 2009 became that kind of turning point. The most common theory is that PRC elites who make foreign policy and security policy decisions judged from the crisis that the United States was now on the verge of declining precipitously, and certain other Western countries and Japan, and now China was finally seeing its day in the sun. That proved to be highly premature, as China's economy is in a shambles now, but that's probably the reason. Either that, and the other possibility is simply that they know that their economic rise is probably only has 5-10 more years at most because of the demographic conclusion problem. So maybe they want to strike while the iron's hot before the window of opportunity closes.
Pradeep Taneja, what would you add?
If you go back to the Chinese claim, the Chinese Communist Party has been making these claims that this is not only historical but also legal, but at the same time they're not willing to have these claims or their claims tested in a court of law, which is really the problem. I mean, the Philippines has called the bluff and said, okay, if you say it is legal, then let's have the claims tested in the court of law. The Chinese have been very reluctant, and they keep going back to their historical claims. But it is also true, when we're talking about the historical context, that it was the Kuomintang government before the Communist Party took power in 1949, which first released the 11-dash line, which has now become the 9-dash line claim. But given that the Chinese are saying that this is both historical and legal, why don't they actually, you know, be prepared to say, okay, let's go to a court of law and let's have this claim tested?
So what international law does govern this? Stephen Noakes?
The closest thing that we have at the moment to a set of institutional oversights is referred to as UNCLOS. It's the UN Convention on the Law of the Sea, which is supposed to provide with countries, a party to this dispute, a mechanism to submit claims that would, in effect, allow them to stake out territory based on the extension of their continental shelf total of 200 nautical miles from their shores. This is, I think, one of the key factors in sort of turning public attention back to the dispute in the spring of 2009. A couple of submissions have been made under this scheme so far, one by the Vietnamese over a portion of the water, including that around the Paracel Islands, and another jointly made by Vietnam and Malaysia for a joint claim over what they simply called a defined area in the middle of the South China Sea that includes a chunk of the water on the Spratlys as well. Brunei, which is also a potential claimant, has not submitted a claim under this mechanism, but has actually gone as far as to provide some preliminary information to the UN, notifying the UN of its intent to submit a claim based on this extension of the continental shelf type of argument.
If I could just add something here, because I would go a little further and say that when we speak of law, we refer to UNCLOS, UN Convention of the Law of the Sea, that's one thing. But also there is international law, the corpus of international law, which was built up in the times preceding the negotiation of UNCLOS. And there we can assess, using international law, we can assess the Chinese claims, because the Chinese always talk about history, indisputable sovereignty, ancient title and so forth, whereas international law does not admit of historical claims. China's references to history clashes with the body of international law and the conventions and the rulings which govern historical title within certain limited areas. And here we have a real conundrum, because the Chinese have said, and many Chinese scholars have said, that our historical claim to the area, say the Chinese, should be recognized because the claim was made prior to international law, and on top of that, you have some with whom I have contact who say that international law was really formulated by Western countries and therefore not applicable to our claim in the South China Sea, and therefore the whole thing should be renegotiated. International law should be renegotiated so it should accept historical claims such as the Chinese claim of the South China Sea. And if the Chinese become much more confident about their claim in this respect, it will be a direct challenge change to what we know as international law.
Pradeep Taneja.
The legal issues are very complex, and as to which law applies, clearly there is one process that the Philippines has taken China to, and that's one, you know, legal avenue. But China first has to be willing to actually agree to have these claims tested in a court of law. And then perhaps, you know, all the claimant states can come to some sort of agreement as to what sort of legal process we want to have. So on the one hand, China claims that, yes, we have historical claims, but also legal claims. But at the same time, we don't want to go to a court of law.
Dan Lynch.
One of the interesting things about the Chinese claim is not only does it predate international law in the minds of people in the Chinese Communist Party, but also just fundamentally takes precedent over anything else that might follow. I mean, if you ask some super patriots in China to debate this issue and ask them, well, what's the basis of China's claim to the South China Sea? The answer is, it just belongs to China. I mean, that's a fundamental precondition. It's China. That's why we claim it, because it's China. Talk about how the ancestors of today's Filipinos must have sailed across those waters, or the ancestors of today's Vietnamese and so on, for millennia even, long before anyone who we would think of today as being Chinese went down there, maybe occasionally. And so if you try to make a logical argument like that, or an international legal argument, it just doesn't matter. On the other hand, though, it's really sensible and clever strategy of the Philippines, especially, to take the matter to international law, because China would probably lose the case. And if so, that'll have an effect on international public opinion. And the Philippines will at least score a moral victory, and that'll be important.
We've talked about some of the claimants, but this affects far more geopolitically than just those few claimants, as I understand it. How would you describe the geopolitics? Stephen Noakes?
There are a number of things at play here. The first, and I think probably most importantly from a broader geopolitical standpoint, is the issue of oil and gas reserves in the seabed. And this is where I think much of the United States' interest comes into play. In 1968, the Chinese ministry responsible for overseeing these sorts of surveys alleged that there were at that time 18 billion tons of oil and gas reserves in the seabed around the Spratlys. So to put that in a bit of context, Kuwait, one of the richest, if not the single richest, Gulf state, is thought to have around 13 billion tons in totals. We're not talking about very little oil under there. We're talking about theoretically enough to power China's economic rise for decades and decades to come. This is also about not simply the oil itself, but the means by which oil gets around the globe. This is about access to shipping lanes to some extent. During the 1980s, there were, on average, about 275 ships passing through the Spratlys region each and every day, and it's now thought to be somewhere in the neighborhood of half the world's total tonnage of supertanker traffic goes through the South China Sea every single year. This is the prime means by which oil from the Middle East makes it to the Chinese seaboard, to Japan, and so on. This is a major, major, major pipeline for oil. It's going to be geopolitically important for these same reasons for China as the One Belt, One Road type initiatives start to take off. The Strait of Malacca is really the gateway to ultimately the Gulf of Aden and the source of all of that oil. Last but not least, I'd say this is partly, anyways, about access to fishing territory, which is quite lucrative as well. In 1980, the South China Sea accounted for roughly 8 or 9% of the total world's catch. So this is a geopolitical issue that has a number of sides to it and consequently draws in a huge number of players.
So you would see this as really important, largely for economic reasons. What about military? I understand there's a military buildup going on as well.
There is. China, for example, is constructing an airstrip and so on, Fiery Cross Reef now. I think to those who would be adversaries, Filipinos, Vietnamese, and so on, certainly that is emblematic of China's growing dominance in the region, and those kinds of symbolic factors can't be discounted, but there are meaningful material issues at play here as well.
Lizak Bozinski?
When you speak of geopolitics, we're looking at the military security dimension, and in particular, I would emphasize the point that Chinese claims to the area present a real challenge to the American position in the Western Pacific. Now, look at it this way, that China's navy is developing. China wants carriers. It wants to project power abroad for various reasons related to the Taiwan conflict, related to protection of its sea lanes and so forth. Now, if you look at China's maritime geography, it can't do that in the north because it's a Korean peninsula, Dalian and so forth, because that area is too close to Japan, and Japan's naval power is also developing. It can't do it in the center because that is Taiwan. That's where Taiwan dominates the area, and Taiwan is closely linked to the state. The only place where it can have outlet to the Pacific or to the Indian Ocean, an outlet for its more carriers will come online in the future, is through the South China Sea, the Malacca Straits, and so forth. So this becomes a very important area for the Chinese Navy. And we certainly think that the Chinese Navy is one of the factors behind China's recent assertive move in the South China Sea, that the Navy has an input, as far as we can understand the situation there. Now, this means that as China really needs to dominate that area, that's what the Navy needs, secure access, that requires control over the area, and achieves that secure access, it affects the American position. Because firstly, Japan would be affected. We had, in terms of the sea lane traffic and so forth, the Japanese fear that China could gain a stranglehold over sea lane traffic to Japan. Of course, it could be rerouted elsewhere, but at considerable cost to the Japanese economy. And that brings Japan and the United States back together. And the United States cannot simply surrender the issue without affecting relations with Japan and Korea. And if the Americans, and some people have said that this issue doesn't concern the United States for the sake of better relations with China, the United States should simply concede the South China Sea to China. But if some American administration did that, it would affect alliance relationships with Japan, Korea, and also within ASEAN. The ASEAN countries would gravitate towards China, and China would emerge as the dominant power in that area. And the United States would be confined to an offshore position in the Western Pacific. Slowly but surely, the United States' position in that area would disintegrate.
Do you agree, Dan Lynch?
Let's remember that at the northern terminus of the South China Sea is Hainan province of China, an island. And that's home to an extremely important naval base for the People's Liberation Army Navy at Sanya. And that is thought to be where the PLA Navy's nuclear-powered submarines are lodged, caves under the water.
Pradeep Taneja.
Yes, I agree with Stephen that energy is a big issue, and the sea lanes, China being one of the biggest trading nations, in fact, the biggest trading nations, there are commercial and energy interests. But I think geopolitics and China's self-perception as the rising power is, I think, what's driving this whole thing. Because if China is to project its power, which would be the best place? Clearly, in the maritime domain, in China's own neighborhood, this would be the best area for China to project power. And South China Sea, somebody's called it, you know, China's Caribbean, for example. I mean, this is where China is trying to demonstrate to the United States and to the rest of the world that it is the greatest power in this part of the world, whether you like it or not, and our power is growing, and therefore we will assert our power. And South China Sea, and particularly the Spratlyan Parasols, have become the kind of the stage for China to project its power. But at the same time, I think we have to remember that there are questions of China's own, you know, multiple identities. On the one hand, China is projecting itself as this rising great power, but at the same time, China has been telling the rest of the world that we will never seek hegemony. The United States is the hegemonic power. We will never be like the United States. We will never seek hegemony. And as far as China's neighbors are concerned in Southeast Asia, China is telling them that our rise, our economic and military rise, is good for you. You have nothing to worry about it. So I think what we are seeing coming out of China is very contradictory, you know, images of how China would like the rest of the world to see itself. I mean, clearly there is a competition with the United States. I've just come back from Beijing and talking to international relations scholars in Beijing. It is very obvious that there is this perception. I mean, people are convinced in China that China is now the rising power and the United States needs to make way for China. And what better place than the South China Sea for China to show to the United States and to the rest of the world that China is now the hegemonic power in this part of the world. So I think it has. We have to consider not only the geopolitical moves, we have to consider domestic factors in China, what's going on in China, in terms of how China defines itself. So on the one hand, China defines itself as a very different power to the United States or other powers of the past, but at the same time, China wants to show that it is a strong and powerful country. So I think the contradictory messages that are coming out of China are also reflected in the policies. For example, we've seen, you know, China abandon Deng Xiaoping's, you know, Cao Guang Yanghui's advice and become much more assertive. But then at the same time, over the last couple of weeks, we have seen China saying that, no, we are stopping construction, you know, in this Spratly. For now, we have done enough. We don't need to do any more. This should suffice for now. So these are conflicting messages. And I think within China, there are debates going on among Chinese scholars as to, you know, how to proceed in this area.
Stephen Noakes.
I would simply add that I think it's absolutely true that there are domestic factors in China that need to be considered in thinking about how Chinese power is projected around the world in whatever form. I think that a lot of this is very difficult for us as outsiders to come to know in a replicable and very credible way sometimes. It's not something we're always privy to. But certainly the internal political dynamics are something that do have to be considered here. And in particular, I think it's going to be very important to remember that the Chinese Communist Party, perhaps despite outward appearances, is like all political parties everywhere in the sense that it has factions, it has wings. It does not think as one, at least not all of the time. And so if there were somebody out there with access sufficient to make a credible case, there are volumes and volumes that could be written on this.
What about the U.S. now? Dan Lynch, you were quoted in a documentary saying that the U.S. is trying to shape China's rise. What's going on there?
When was the documentary exactly?
Oh, gosh. I think this was a few years ago, but I dredged it up.
8 years ago? Yeah, well, I think it's long been United States policy. I mean, it's open record to welcome China into the international community. And that concretely meant paving the way for China to enter the World Trade Organization and other such institutions. But also in the hope that the more radical foreign policy orientations and domestic policies of decades past would fade away over time. The term in Chinese for this is peaceful evolution. That's not a positive term in China, but it's basically what it was all about. So how does that relate to this, you're asking? I guess, I mean, a lot of people are now saying that at least for those people who are really enthusiastic about constructive engagement leading to change in China and really believing that was going to be a major development, have been shown to be wrong, and because it's not happening. If anything, it looks like China, I mean, and other people that were saying all along, China is far too big, far too complex, and far older. The age matters in China, older than the United States, and it will not be changed by the United States. And so that's one of the debates going on right now in the United States. But there's no solution as to what to do, because you really have no choice but to engage China. I mean, it's a net positive in most ways, I'd say. And what are you going to do? The only alternative is confrontation that could prove very dangerous. But definitely it's shaping the debate here.
Stephen Noakes.
I think that Dan is absolutely right. I think it's certainly true that China is extremely unlikely to be convinced of a course of action that it doesn't necessarily already favor for its own reasons. And so I think what that probably means is that the United States can do a certain amount of agenda setting by, say, providing China with a certain range of conceivable options or something like that. But it is simply not the case that those who would make the sorts of policies that manifest themselves in the South China Sea are particularly receptive to American thinking on the issue anyways. And even if they were, there's no concrete mechanism by which they could be convinced. So there really is no alternative to this process of socializing China, if you like. It's the opposite of the old-time Cold War era strategy of isolation. The thinking was that if Cuba was left to flounder on its own, eventually it would crumble and see the light. Well, that turned out not to be the case. So really, there's nothing left to do but open the doors and do your best to see a certain amount of values transference from the United States and from other key players in the international community. The risky side of this is the other side of the coin. What if China's not simply a norm taker, but a norm maker? In what ways we expect an ascendant China to actually recreate some of the rules of the game? And what can we expect? Is that something we are prepared to grapple with?
Simultaneously, you know, I saw in the news that there are some military exercises going on with the U.S. being involved and Japan being involved. I think this is particularly in the Philippines. Is this significant with regards to the dispute?
Sure. A lot of these have gone on for years in a regular exercise, but there are not only exercises going on, but Japan and the Philippines are working really closely together. As I understand it, the Japanese Coast Guard, which is almost like a Navy now after a lot of increases in spending and so on in the 2000s, working really closely with the Philippines Coast Guard, supplying ships and other sorts of vessels. And I believe Japan's doing that with Vietnam, too. So there are a lot of things like that going on, not necessarily the United States directly doing it, but U.S. allies. And even Japan's even working with India to help turn India even more of an export powerhouse, all with thinking in mind that we need to balance against China's rise. So this is engagement, but it's engagement with kind of a backdoor or an insurance hedging. It's not relying entirely on engagement, hoping China is socialized into the kind of state that others might like to see, but also just in case it doesn't work out, arming and training some of China's adversaries in the South China Sea.
Zach Buzinski, what would you add?
Those military exercises that you refer to are indicative of greater regional concern in relation to China's assertive moves in the area. What China has been doing in the South China Sea is linked with what China's been doing in relation to the Japan and Sengoku Daiyu situation. That draws Japan in. So you have, with this steady assertiveness that we've witnessed on the part of China in that area, we've also seen a great propensity amongst the ASEAN countries to seek out greater support against China. Now, I find it very interesting that both Indonesia and Malaysia are seeking out, looking for a closer security relationship with the United States. They don't want to speak about it publicly because they talk in terms of non-alignment and neutrality and so forth, and they don't want to be considered allies of the U.S., but they're very worried and they're very concerned, and they have initiated steps towards greater security cooperation with the United States. And this means that China could be faced with a situation where the United States would be able to orchestrate security coalitions in the South China Sea in relation to China. And that makes the Chinese draw back. Earlier, we had this discussion about U.S.-China relations and, of course, engagement and so forth, dialogue. But within the context of engagement and dialogue, I see these security relationships, security coalitions building up, which include Australia as well, not New Zealand. And this will make the Chinese, I think, draw back. So it's a process of moving forward for the Chinese and then drawing back, moving forward and then drawing back. As far as we understand traditional Chinese strategy culture, they have no intention of precipitating a clash, a conflict. They don't work that way. They move slowly and incrementally. And where the United States and its allies draw certain red lines, then they will draw back and wait for the future. And the future will be more propitious for a similar move. If the United States and its allies can hold firm, Japan will hold firm. There are some questions about a future United States administration. Then China will simply bide its time. And the situation may change in China, and China indeed may ease the pressure in that area.
Pradeep Taneja.
If you talk about the United States' interest here, lately we've seen a spate of studies coming out of the United States saying that constructive engagement with China hasn't quite worked. Now, it's worked in the sense that it's maintained a degree of stability, but China continues to rise. China continues to challenge the United States' position, particularly in this part of the world. So for the U.S., I think the South China Sea has become a test case. If the U.S. doesn't succeed in its strategy in the South China Sea, then certainly there's no stopping China in other parts of the world. So in terms of projection of Chinese power, it is going to continue to grow. The U.S. approach in the South China Sea has been that, yes, we are not a claimant state, but at the same time, we would like this dispute to be settled in a peaceful manner. The U.S. has been championing a code of conduct in the South China Sea. We saw in 2002 a declaration on the code of conduct. 13 years later, we still don't have a code of conduct. So U.S. position is that We really want to, as Stephen said, socialize China into the norms that have been created over the past six, seven decades. But at the same time, China is dragging its feet when it comes to the code of conduct. So while China talks about, you know, legal and historical claims, when it comes to actually setting legal precedents or creating a framework for a, you know, peaceful resolution of this problem, China seems to be dragging its feet. So for the U.S., I think the South China Sea has become a test case in terms of how it deals with China and particularly the rise of China.
So how do we see this resolving? Lezak Bozinski, do you see a path to resolution here?
Everyone expects or at least discusses resolution. Very unlikely. This issue has been going on for decades, well before the 1988 incident. We should look at the January 74 case when the Chinese expelled the South Vietnamese from the Western Paracels. No, it'll simply continue. The Chinese have much at stake here. The Chinese cannot back down. No Chinese leadership can back down over this issue. The Chinese party has whipped up nationalism over this. Many Chinese scholars in Beijing and elsewhere are thoroughly convinced that it had always been, it always has been Chinese territory. They didn't say that in the past. This is a recent development, this strong belief that it is Chinese territory. Going to law to negotiate or to negotiate with ASEAN or the ASEAN claimants over this issue is simply not on for the Chinese. They'll simply wait it out and hope that sometime in the future the time will be more propitious for them to assert their claims once more. No. Some issues in international affairs are not susceptible to immediate resolution. They just carry on. And sometimes we have to live with them. The Korean Peninsula is another issue. They just carry on.
Dan Lynch?
I think that's absolutely right. But there's also an elephant in the living room here, and that is that the Chinese economic development model strikes me as already right now bankrupt. We don't have time to go into detail to all the indicators, the signs, but basically, they've been relying on excessive investment relative to consumption and even net exports to grow GDP. And to the point, though, where they've run out of viable investment projects. And so people, especially state-owned enterprises, have been taking out bank loans, investing in projects that aren't generating revenues. They should pay back the loans. So they take out new loans to service the old loans. So that now the debt-to-GDP ratio has reached 282% as of 2 weeks ago. And there's just a lot of other indicators. And this is, by the way, almost universally recognized among Chinese economists. So I think would be, if they were in charge, they'd be much less likely to pursue such a forward policy in the South China. So this is likely, I think, to unfold over the next 5-6 years, become obvious to everyone. What we don't know, though, is what that would mean for foreign policy. I mean, if the Chinese leadership is united and rational, then you'd want to pull back a little bit. And instead of investing $49 billion in Pakistan as part of One Belt, One Road and the, you know, tens of billions of other dollars they plan to invest in other parts of the world, it's a reflection of that investment-driven economic growth. They need to take those resources and thoroughly clean up the Chinese environment, because now the death rates are rising again, people over 50. And kids who are growing up in that environment are going to be supremely unhealthy and probably die young. So, and there are water shortages. Those aren't sexy investments and eye-catching investments necessarily, but that is where the most good could be done instead of this kind of foreign policy adventurism. So we don't know whether they'll choose the rise of force or if, because they feel embattled now that the rise, people will stop using that term rise of China. They'll probably start using rise of India instead. How will the PLA, which has an enormous influence over security policy, react possibly in a defensive and more aggressive? Don't know how that'll turn out.
I agree with Lezak that this is something which is not going to be resolved anytime soon. This is a problem that's going to continue. But there is another issue, I think, which is related to the end game, and that is China's grand strategy. And there seems to be a grand strategy emerging in China. And Xi Jinping's One Belt, One Road initiative seems to be part of that grand strategy. And in fact, the recent decision, an announcement by the Chinese government that we've kind of done enough in terms of land reclamation in the South China Sea, may be linked to that grand strategy, because China cannot expect to get the cooperation of all of its, you know, Asian neighbors, and particularly Southeast Asian neighbors, and at the same time keep very aggressively asserting its territorial claims. And if the One Belt, One Road, and particularly the maritime, you know, Silk Road, if that is the bigger game in China, then I think we could see China slowing down it's the aggressive position in the South China Sea in the interest of a bigger or grander strategy. But that's one hope, that China may in fact start to ease up a little bit in the South China Sea.
Stephen Oakes?
I think it's probably true that this can't be immediately resolved and that it won't be. I think likely what you'll see is periodic flare-ups and the issue recede into abeyance only to be resurrected every couple of years or something like that. I suppose in a theoretical kind of sense, I'm simply too much of a realist to have a lot of faith in institutions as always being effective mechanisms for dispute resolution. Normally, they depend on a substantial buy-in from players, as we've already heard, who might not necessarily feel like making those buy-ins. And for that reason, I think that you won't see this disappear from the headlines for the foreseeable future.
Taiwan election for the president in January. Probably the DPP will win. They might even win the legislature in March. That could usher in a sea change, and it could bring out hawks in Chinese foreign policy circles again. So that there's a wild card.
And just for listeners who don't know, that is because?
That's because the DPP, the opposition, which looks likely to definitely win the presidency, possibly take the legislature for the first time in history, would control both the major branches of government. And it's officially in favor of realizing de jure independence from China and does not accept the one China principle. So it's inherently provocative to the PRC.
Gentlemen, thank you so much for this. Pradeep Taneja, Leszek Baczynski, Dan Lynch, Stephen Oakes, thank you so much for being with us here on the Scholar Circle.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you very much.
Dr. Pradeep Taneja lectures in the School of Social and Political Sciences at the University of Melbourne and is the author of The European Union and China, Interests and Dilemmas. Dr. Stephen Oakes is a lecturer in politics and international relations and Asian studies at the University of Auckland. He's the author of Support for Civil Society in China. Daniel Lynch is professor of international relations at the University of Southern California and the author of After the Propaganda State, Media, Politics and Thought in Reform China, Rising China, and Asian Democratization. Leszek Baczynski is a professor at Australian National University and the author of Asia-Pacific Security, Values and Identity. That's it for our show. Thank you to all of our guests and to our producers, Ankine Aghasyan, Melissa Chiprin, and to our webmaster, Sud Dongre. Most of all, thank you for listening. And if you missed any part of the show, go to kpfk.org, click on the audio archives, or you can go to armudian.com, scholarcircle.org, or you can follow us at Armudian. We'll see you next week.
It's time for peace. No time for war. It's time for peace. Oh, what are we fighting for? It's time for peace. Time for peace. It's time for peace. Oh, yeah. Time for peace. We'll stop the killing fields in the desert sand. We'll end the war machines all across the land. Let me tell you, it's time for peace. It's time for peace. It's time.